VOA News. I'm Christopher Cruz reporting. Both sides in the UN-sponsored peace talks on Yemen have rejected an initial proposal for ending the fighting in the key port city of Hodeidah. Reports say the Saudi-led coalition would lay down their arms while the Iranian-backed Houthi rebels who controlled the city would retreat. A UN administration would temporarily take over. Despite the initial rejection, the UN representative Martin Griffiths says this is just an early draft and such proposals are always being revised. An accused Russian spy held by the United States on charges of infiltrating Republican Party circles to provide information to Moscow has reached a deal with prosecutors to plead guilty. Maria Butina, who was arrested in July and has been detained since then, says will appear in a Washington court as soon as Tuesday, although the criminal offenses to which she's expected to plead guilty have not yet been disclosed. Her attorneys said in court filings that the case against her has now been, quote, resolved. The U.S. Justice Department alleged that Butina was a covert Russian agent. They say her work in the U.S. was directed by a former Russian lawmaker who was sanctioned by the U.S. Treasury Department for his alleged ties to Russian President Vladimir Putin. A Chinese court has ordered a ban in the country on several iPhone models because of a patent dispute between iPhone maker Apple and U.S. chipmaker Qualcomm. The court granted Qualcomm's request for preliminary injunctions against four subsidiaries of Apple, ordering them to immediately stop selling the iPhone 6S through the iPhone 10 that use older versions of Apple's iOS operating system. This is VOA News. The detained Huawei chief financial officer, Meng Wanzhou, says she should be released on bail in Canada over health concerns while waiting on a hearing for extradition to the U.S. A Canadian court is considering whether to grant bail to the chief financial officer for Huawei while she awaits possible extradition. The court in Vancouver heard a second day of testimony Monday. Testimony will resume on Tuesday. Reuters correspondent Ryan Brooks reports.
Court documents showed U.S. authorities accuse her of misleading banks and putting those banks at risk of breaking U.S. sanctions on Iran. They allege she was trying to use those banks to move money out of Iran. Court documents also show that in the meantime, she wants to be released, and not only on grounds she suffers from hypertension. She's also citing her longstanding ties with Canada and mentioned she owns two homes worth millions in Vancouver. Meng is not only CFO, she's also the daughter of the founder of Huawei, one of China's key tech companies. It's the world's biggest supplier of networking hardware. China has demanded Meng's immediate release.
Neither Canada nor the U.S. has provided China with any evidence that Meng has broken any law in those two countries.
Her arrest has put global markets on edge, with investors worried it could sabotage any chance of a trade deal between Washington and Beijing.
The United States is placing sanctions on three senior North Korean officials for what it says is the regime's ongoing and serious human rights abuses and censorship. The U.S. Treasury Department said the three officials run departments that perpetuate abuses to suppress and control the population. From the European Union turned even more chaotic Monday when the Prime Minister, Theresa May, postponed a House of Commons vote on her Brexit withdrawal plan. That agreement took months of negotiations with Brussels to conclude. She spoke Monday to a packed and rowdy House of Commons.
As a result, if we went ahead and held the vote tomorrow, the deal would be rejected by a significant margin. We will therefore defer the vote scheduled for tomorrow and not proceed to divide the House at this time.
Her aides say cabinet ministers implored her not to move ahead, urging her to return to Brussels to try to secure more concessions before the House of Commons has the final say. But immediately upon learning of the postponement, the European Commission ruled out renegotiations, and the EU Council President Donald Tusk called for a summit Thursday to examine ways to help Britain ratify the deal. You can find more on these and other late-breaking and developing stories from around the world, around the clock, at voanews.com and on the VOA News mobile app. I'm Christopher Cruz, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Tuesday, December 11th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The European Union extends sanctions on the ruling party presidential candidate in the Democratic Republic of Congo.
This is not a new position of the European Union. It doesn't influence the position of the Congolese people because these sanctions are unfair.
Andre Alain Atundu is the spokesman for the ruling coalition in the DRC. An independent candidate in Congo's December 23rd election says the ruling party candidate should step down as a result of the European Union sanctions. A new report says more than 200 civilians were killed this year alone in Mali, and Cameroon's government asks religious leaders to pray for an end to corruption.
There have been requests that a special fund be created so that most of this stolen money should be taken from these guys and put in a special fund which is dedicated to probably some kind of infrastructure development in our country. That is not happening.
Emmanuel Ari is a political affairs lecturer at the Catholic University of Central Africa. Kenyans and Ugandans decry human rights violations in their respective countries, and Rwanda's defense forces say they repelled an attack by the FDLR militia. Those stories plus our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. A spokesman for President Joseph Kabila's ruling coalition has accused the European Union of trying to subvert the will of the people of the Democratic Republic of Congo to choose their own leaders. Andre Alain Atundu's comment came after the European Union on Monday agreed to extend sanctions on ruling coalition candidate Emmanuel Ramazani Shadari and 13 others. The sanctions were imposed in December 2016 on those who were believed to be obstructing the electoral process. Atundu says the sanctions are immoral because the real purpose is to push Mr. Shadari out of contesting the December 23rd election. But he says the Congolese people will defend their sovereignty.
This is not a new position of the European Union. It doesn't influence the position of the Congolese people because these sanctions are unfair. And everyone knows that the target of these sanctions is to put Mr. Shadari out of running presidential election. I think it's immoral to interfere in this manner in our election, in the decision of the Congolese people to choose these leaders. These sanctions are unfair because they are not a result of the judgment from a court. But we Congolese people, we have to safeguard our sovereignty, the dignity of our people.
The European Union imposed these sanctions in 2016 because they thought that President Kabila and others were an obstacle to holding elections.
If the basic reason was these people were an obstacle for the electoral process, now that this process is in progress to the voting day, is it normal that these sanctions be put again? It's something I don't understand really, because this political target of the European Union is not in the interest of democracy, in the interest of the Congolese people.
Let me say what this Noel Shiani, who is an independent candidate, he said that Mr. Shadari should step down, not to run as candidate of the ruling coalition.
For Mr. Shadari to step down, first of all, it depends on his own will or the will of the party that support him. Or if Mr. Shadari doesn't feel some condition of the electoral commission, he should step. But now, Mr. Shadari is a man of conviction. He's a man of struggle.
Mr. Atundu, thank you very much. It's always a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you, James.
Andre Alain Atundu is the spokesman for DRC President Joseph Kabila's ruling coalition. You're speaking with me from the capital, Kinshasa. An independent candidate in the Democratic Republic of Congo is calling on Emmanuel Ramazani Shadari, the presidential candidate of the ruling party, to step down before the December 23rd presidential poll. This after welcoming the European Union's renewed sanctions against Shadari and 13 others. Noel Shiani of the opposition Force for Change tells viewers Peter Clotty the sanctions will serve as a deterrent to perpetrators of violence and gross human rights abuses.
I welcome that news with a lot of gladness because the European Union is doing the right thing for the Congolese people. Those 14 individuals were accused for violating human rights and obstructing electoral process. There is nothing which has changed to justify the removal of the sanctions. So the fact that the European Union Council has renewed those sanctions is welcome news for the Congolese people because we believe that those individuals constitute a major problem for our country, and particularly Emmanuel Shadary is a presidential candidate representing the ruling party. He was minister in charge of interior when many of the abuses of human rights were taking place in the country. For example, in the Kasai province, the Kamwena Nsapu phenomenon, which has caused close to 90 mass graves in which almost 4,000 to 5,000 people have been buried. So he was not able to protect those Congolese citizens. So I believe that it is maybe time for him to quit the race.
Are you calling on Emmanuel Shadary, the presidential candidate for the ruling party, to step down from contesting in the election coming up in less than 2 weeks?
Yes, I am calling on Emmanuel Shadary to step down as a presidential candidate, not only because of the sanctions by the European Union, but also he has been violating almost every single law. For example, his campaign team includes those people who are under European Union sanctions. In addition to that, the president of the National Assembly and some other high-profile authorities in the country who should stay out of the taking side between different candidates who should be neutral, those people are in the team that Emmanuel Shadary is using for conducting his campaign. Almost the public media have been confiscated. The public funds are being used abusively by his team. So I believe that it is time for him to quit if we have to have a fair and transparent electoral process, which is going to lead to elections on December 23rd, 2018.
But some people are saying if every political party representative will have an equal playing field, then it was unreasonable for the European Union to renew sanctions on Emmanuel Shadary and 13 others at this time, particularly when it's less than 2 weeks for the presidential election, which will have an undue influence of people turning away from him. Don't you think?
Well, I don't believe so, because those sanctions were put in place before even Emmanuel Shadary was a presidential candidate. So nothing has changed to justify removing the sanctions. So European Union is just doing the right thing. If he is on the list of sanctions, the sanctions are going to be renewed anyway. The question that we have to ask ourselves is, why is he under sanction? He's under sanction because he's accused of violating human rights and also for obstructing the electoral process, and those conditions have not changed yet.
Noel Shiani is an independent candidate in the December 23rd DRC presidential election. He spoke with viewers Peter Clotty from the capital, Kinshasa. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Botti in Washington. Today is Tuesday, December 11th. Daybreak Africa time. It's 13 minutes past the hour. Human rights activists in Uganda are calling on government agencies, mainly security personnel, to end human rights abuses in the country. Mendi Kagwa, chairman of the Uganda Human Rights Commission, says there are continuing reports of human rights violations in the country. He wants perpetrators to be prosecuted for violating the rights of others. Mugumi Davis Rakerange reports from Kampala.
Speaking Monday at the commemoration of this year's International Human Rights Day, Kagwa says, unfortunately, human rights violations are committed by people who ought to protect them.
There are regrettably a number of incidents and reports of human rights violations the country continues to witness. These include incidents of the violation of freedom from torture, freedom of expression and association, deprivation of life, especially during the recent Arua clashes, prevalence of brutal arrest of suspects, violence against journalists, deprivation of personal liberty, allegations of illegal detention and deprivation of property, among others.
Ugandan opposition leaders have often been arrested or detained by security personnel for holding rallies or attempting to hold demonstrations. Recently, some members of the opposition, including members of the parliament, were detained on charges of treason after campaigning for an opposition politician. The MPs claimed they were brutally tortured by security personnel during the arrest or while in detention. Speaking at the same function, Bart Katureebe, Uganda's chief justice, said these violations should be brought to an end. Uganda has ratified many international human rights conventions. The Ugandan constitution also provides for non-discrimination and equality for all citizens. The constitution also has specific provisions enshrined to ensure the rights of women, people with disabilities, and children are respected. Katurebe said those who abuse human rights of others should be prosecuted.
When a person is alleged or seen to have committed a crime, he should be arrested. But the arrest should be with a view to taking him before a court of law for his prosecution, conviction, or acquittal.
Emiliani Kaima, Uganda's police spokesman, told VOA that the police force is working towards ensuring citizens' rights are not tampered with.
This week, we are going to launch our police human rights policy that will go a long way to strengthen and broaden issues of human rights in our service industry, serving the people.
Both Katurebe and Medi Kagwa say in order to achieve lasting peace and development in the country, there must be respect of human rights. For VOA News, I am Mugume, Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
Human rights activists in Kenya staged demonstrations on Monday in the coastal part of the country as Kenyans joined the world to commemorate International Human Rights Day. As Maureen Ojiambo reports from Nairobi, Kenya's Interior Cabinet Secretary Fred Matiang'i has called on civil society groups and human rights activists to stop making alarming statements against police officers about human rights violations.
According to the lobby groups, at least 71 people have either been killed or forced to disappear since last year. At the coastal region of Kenya, Mombasa recorded the highest cases of killings, followed by Tana River. Then Kwale and Lamu counties took the third position, as Kilifi recorded the lowest number. According to Hassan Abdile, the Muhuru executive director, the lobby groups shall have a meeting with the Ministry of Interior to address the issue of extrajudicial killings that is prevalent in the coastal region.
It's quite disappointing that on this day, 70 years since the United Nations adopted the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, some countries are still engaging in some aspects that undermine human dignity.
However, the Interior Ministry has refuted claims that the police officers in Kenya led in violation of human rights. In a statement, the Interior Cabinet Secretary Fred Matiang'i maintained that the government is committed to deliver justice to any civilian whose rights might have been abused by the police. Speaking in Nairobi during the commemoration of the International Human Rights Day, Turkana Governor Josphat Nanok said that the government cooperated with other agencies to ensure human rights, especially for the refugees, are upheld.
To promote Article 48 of the Constitution on access to justice, there has been meaningful cooperation between the judiciary and the county government, wherein the latter donate land for the construction of courts.
United Nations resident coordinator in Kenya, Siddharth Shataje, said that despite the country's efforts to protect human rights, there is need to bring to book those who go against the human rights. The deputy chairperson in Kenya National Commission of Human Rights, George Morara, has said that the cases of extrajudicial killings have decreased this year compared to the past years. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights is a milestone document in the history of human rights that was adopted and proclaimed by the United Nations General Assembly on December 10, 1948, as a common standard of achievement for all people and the nations. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Nairobi, Kenya.
Muslim and Christian leaders gather in Cameroon's capital Yaoundé over the weekend to pray for an end to corruption in the country. Government officials want them to preach anti-corruption messages to their congregations. But some observers think religious institutions should first clean up themselves. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
Muslim faithful sing in the main hall of the Yaoundé Conference Center, where some 700 religious leaders and their faithful gathered to discuss corruption. Cameroon's National Anti-Corruption Commission, CONAC, called the meeting to persuade clergy members to join its battle. Connacht's chair, Jordan Masigams, himself a pastor of the Evangelical Church, says clergy can help by preaching anti-corruption messages in their churches.
If our country is considered as one of the most religious, it is not acceptable that we continue to be under the weight of the corruption. Religious people must be really engaged to transform themselves. Corruption is a sin and it is the fruit of the devil.
Charlie Mine Diteme, senior pastor of the Cameroon Baptist Convention, says the initiative taken by GAMS is good, but that religious bodies in Cameroon are highly corrupt and should do a self-examination first.
The church is corrupt from within. Take, for example, whenever there are elections for national leaders across the board, Christians, they cease to be Christians. They form camps, they bribe, and I say this with tears in my eyes. The church is corrupt, and I'm still calling on the church to clean her doors, clean her front yard before going to the public.
Connacht has arrested about 40 ministers and heads of state corporations on corruption charges in recent years. The government estimates that about $250 million in public funds has been stolen. Emmanuel Are, political affairs lecturer at the Catholic University of Central Africa, says Connacht should tell Cameroonians how much money has been recovered instead of asking pastors and imams to pray against corruption.
There have been requests that a special fund be created so that most of this stolen money should be taken from these guys and put in a special fund which is dedicated to probably some kind of infrastructure development in our country. That is not happening, and people are locked up, some for 15 years, and they are released without us knowing exactly whether money has been recovered or not.
In 2015, anti-corruption watchdog Transparency International ranked Cameroon as one of the most corrupt nations in Africa, alongside South Africa, Ghana, Nigeria, and Liberia. Transparency International said corruption creates and increases poverty. It said whistleblowing is key to fighting graft, but that many people are afraid to come forward as they feel it will be dangerous or ineffective. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
Militias have killed more than 200 civilians in Mali during 2018, including 10 massacres of Peul populations, according to a new report by Human Rights Watch. Corinne Dufka, Human Rights Watch Sahel director, says the research uncovered attacks by armed groups against 42 villages.
2018 has seen a very worrying increase in killings and other abuses by ethnically allied civil defense militias. This violence is taking place within the context of the growth of armed Islamist or jihadist groups in central Mali, which has been increasing since 2015. These groups have concentrated their recruitment on the Pul or Fulani ethnic group. And so the Bambara and Dogon civil defense militias have stepped in to, they say, defend their communities from attacks by the jihadists. In the process, they have been killing many Pul civilians.
So do you think that one of the reasons for this increase is a response to the jihadist militias in the region, and how much of it is based on actual violence by the jihadists and how much it is based on fear?
Community leaders from all three groups, that is the Dogon, the Bambara, and the Pul, complain about the lack of presence and the lack of protection of their communities by members of the Malian army. And the Dogon and Bambara militias very clearly say that they have had no other choice but to protect their communities and form these militias and then protect their communities. And it is true that there have indeed been some attacks against members of their community, including civilians, by the jihadists. However, we have noted that the worst atrocities, including most of the massacres that we documented, occurred after one or two members of the Bambara Dogon communities were killed by the armed Islamists. And then they reacted by attacking an entire hamlet or village of Pul and killing often dozens of people in response.
What has been the Malian government's response thus far? And, you know, what do you guys hope can happen in the future to decrease this communal violence?
The Malian government has said they are extremely aware and concerned about the increasing communal violence, and they are doing their best to try to address it. And progressively, they said during 2018, they have addressed it by establishing 16 security posts in vulnerable areas and starting to disarm the militias. The leaders of all communities have expressed concern about the lack of security. And the poll particularly criticized the army for failing to neutrally and impartially apply a ban on motorcycles and to disarm the abusive militias. Early in 2018, the prime minister, during a visit to central Mali, promised to disarm the militias and promised to hold any abusive militias to account. And they claim that there has been inadequate application and implementation of these promises.
What are the other effects of this upsurge in violence?
In addition to the killings, there has been a systematic effort on the part of armed groups representing both communities to blockade villages so that it makes it extremely difficult for people to go to market. And indeed, this year, there's been at least 10,000 displaced who have had to flee their homes, and also a hunger crisis.
That was Corinne Dufka, the Sahel director at Human Rights Watch. She was speaking to Ricky Stryer from Washington, D.C. The Rwanda Defense Force, RDF, has confirmed that 7 suspected members of the FDLR militia based in the Democratic Republic of Congo were killed in Rubavu district. An RDF spokesperson says the militia were repelled, but one Rwanda civilian was severely injured. Eugene Uimana has more from Kigali.
The exchange of fires took 1 hour from the Monday midnight. The attack is said to come from the Democratic Republic of Congo. Some Rwandan civilians who were on district routine patrols explained how the attack was. At 12:48 a.m., bullets were seriously bursting, and I immediately called the executive secretary of our sector. Then he called the other leaders. It was a time when the Rwanda Defense Patrol had left, and that group came from there carrying bags, explosives, and wearing chains in necks. We stopped them, and one of them said, "These are civilians. Let's move on." After arriving at that tab, they started dispatching themselves. Then suddenly, we started to hear the exchange of fires. The Rwanda Defense Force spokesperson, Lieutenant Colonel Innocent Munyengango, say that this group is thought to be the FDLR. We think they are FDLR, according to their addresses. We also found a Kalashnikov gun with them. This shows that those who don't like our security are still active, but our soldiers are effectively protecting our borders. Abdelman Gilbert, the mayor of Rubavu district, assures that after this attack, leaders are sensitizing the population to inform on time security organs. We talked with the citizens and we agreed on a collaboration mechanism. We think now everything is in normal condition. It's not the first time that FDLR rebellions attack this Rwandan district, which holds the DRC border. FDLR, the Democratic Forces for the Liberation of Rwanda, is an armed labor group active in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. The FDLR is considered to be the last factions of genocidals active in the Congo. It was founded through an amalgamation of Hutu groups in September 2000. Eugene Wimana for VOA News, Kigali.
That's it for this Tuesday, December 11th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Butte in Washington, hoping you in Africa will have a good day.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, a look at the recent release of political prisoners in Rwanda. U.S. lawmakers are pressing Rwanda's government against incarcerating a dissident politician. Those issues and more on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
The 2019 Voice of America calendars are in. This year's calendar features a variety of scenic photos that capture the beautiful byways of the United States, including magnificent photos of California's Big Sur Coast Highway, West Virginia's Highland Scenic Highway, and even the Cato All-American Road in Maine. Tune into Border Crossings and call to request a free calendar.
Thank you.